Welcome to the Nerd Party.
There's a wind that blows in from the north, and it says that loving takes its course. Come here.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. Good to be back. We've been gone for a little while, not that long. I'm not gonna lie, you probably didn't miss us, but now that we're back, you probably are overwhelmed with just insane amounts of joy. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge, and joining me today, a fellow nerd partier, John Mills. John, thank you so much for being here.
I'm thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled that you're back, and I'm just thrilled in general. Because being thrilled is an exciting place to be.
Your pants are nowhere to be seen, and I know for a fact that means thrills. Chills, and kills.
And spills.
And spills.
Lots of spills. That's why I don't have pants on, is because I spilled things on them.
There you go. Whatever floats your boat. But we are here. I'm very excited about this. So we're a little late. I wanted to do another romantic movie for the month of love.
So, February. Of course, I was the natural choice.
Yes, exactly. There you go. Please put your pants back on. But we're running a little late. So at the beginning of the month, we watched The Notebook, which is one of the worst movies I think I've ever seen. And
it sure seemed like it.
Yeah.
I have to say, I still haven't watched it. And I'm pretty sure you sold me on not doing so.
Don't. You don't have to. So I wanted to balance things out with another romantic movie. And I decided to go in the exact opposite direction with a movie that I think is very genuine and heartfelt and feels like real people who actually love each other instead of fake models who make me hate my life. So we're watching one of my actually, I hesitate to call this or to set it up as like, this is my favorite movie, but it's true. I am a huge fan of this movie. I would go so far as to say this is my favorite series of movies. And it's Before Sunrise, directed by Richard Linklater. And the reason I'm hesitant to hype it up, because it is, these are my personal favorite films. If I had to rank, you know, they would be at the top. And I hesitate to do that. No, I don't. I'm egotistical, terrible.
No, stop it.
I want everyone to hear
it.
My opinion. But the truth is, these movies are so unassuming and so simple that to hype them up as anything is doing them a disservice. And that makes it, I feel like I'm damning it with faint praise, but the truth is these movies are so, so carefree and so just so unpretentious that I don't want to give it this whole like greatest movie ever feel.
That seems to be sort of Linklater's wheelhouse, though.
Yeah.
The unassuming film,
the
low-key sort of thing. I mean, I'm not terribly familiar with Linklater's works. I'm not going to lie. I'm familiar with him.
Right.
Like, I know of him, and I think I've seen a thing or two that he's done. But I remember, is he the one that did SFW back in the 1990s?
No,
was that
I don't
somebody
think so.
Else?
That's someone okay. else.
But that's in the same sort of like Richard Linklater was known for slacker stuff because he did what's that one with
Slacker?
No, you know the one I'm talking about.
Dazed and Confused.
That's the one.
Yes,
which I did not like.
I don't like it either.
Okay, see, so, all right, which see is, that's hopeful to me because that means that your love for this is if you can criticize the work of somebody that you enjoy.
Yes. And it's interesting, you know, Dazed and Confused is a very interesting thing. I feel like already people are freaking out because that is such a beloved movie.
Yeah.
But and to say I don't like it, that might be a little strong. I'm not a huge fan of it. It's definitely, I don't like it as much as everyone else seems to like it. And obviously, if I were to pick a favorite Linklater movie, it would definitely not be that. I would pick School of Rock before I pick that.
And so, that's
not to insult School of Rock at all, because I think School of Rock is great. But it's definitely Dazed and Confused, I think it has the higher, it's more esteemed. It has the bigger reputation.
And what was great about School of Rock is, I didn't realize Linklater did that, but the thing is, that immediately to me makes me think, oh, okay, maybe he is a good director, because, I know that this seems weird, but like Jack Black is one of those actors who, he can do great things when the right director is, you know, shepherding him along.
Yeah.
When the wrong director is shepherding him along, you get King Kong. And when you get the right director, you get School of Rock.
Sure. Or, the Neverending Story 3, which Jack Black was also in.
I didn't know that existed.
Well, we got to get it on the show.
Isn't that false advertising? The Neverending Story 3? You lied to me the first two times. Why am I going to go see this?
I know. It's not right. It's like Final Fantasy. It's like, come on, we're on to you now. But yeah, exactly. So before Sunrise, this was Richard Linklater's third film. Technically, mm-hmm. this is his fourth film. He made, I don't know if it was technically a feature. It was called You Can't Learn to Plow by Reading Books. And it was basically just a movie about him living his life. Nothing happening, which is kind of his thing.
Yeah, and, again, in his wheelhouse.
Yes. So then he did Slacker, which, again, is I find interesting, but I'm not a huge fan of.
I did not see Slacker, but what's interesting that you're telling me with Linklater, and I know that he is a beloved director, right?
Yeah.
Is that there's a guy, I actually have his book from ages past. I don't know why I haven't thrown the thing out yet, but Lou Hunter.
Okay.
Legendary, like, screenwriting class guy from, like, ages past. And his whole thing in his book and in his classes was, you can't have somebody that doesn't do something. It's got to be somebody that does something.
It's,
something
it's
exciting,
all about
and
drama,
real.
Conflict,
right.
Things,
you know,
like,
you
got
to be out there, and you got to be an adventurer, or you got to be an alien, or you got to be something like that. And yeah. Linklater seems to be complete 180 from that. Do you think that that's just because the sense of cinema has evolved, or that people like Lou Hunter are no longer around putting that idea in people's heads?
I think both. I mean, cinema, especially going through like 60s, 70s, you're going in by this point, and we've kind of proven that almost anything can work, yeah. regardless of whether or not you call it successful. Movies can be made and make money that are unconventional and sometimes not even that good. And Linklater and he and Kevin Smith and Soderbergh, they kind of all came out of
that's for you, Mike Schindler.
There you go.
Here on the Nerd Party Network.
That they all kind of came out of like that late 80s, early 90s movement of independent filmmakers. And yeah. Linklater was directly, you might hate him for this, but I think he was directly responsible for Kevin Smith making Clerks, because
Clerks is a great movie.
I love Clerks too.
My,
yeah.
My beef with Kevin Smith doesn't start.
Let me wait, hold on. Let me clarify. I love Clerks 2, T-O-O, not Clerks 2, number 2.
Nobody loves Clerks 2. Nobody in their right mind loves Clerks 2.
But
there is somebody with a woman trapped in a well in their basement that loves Clerks 2, and that's it.
She puts the lotion on her skin.
Yes, yes. Or she watches Clerks 2 again.
Oh, God. But Slacker came out, I think it was 91, and it was made in Austin, which was not a center for film at the time at all. Yeah. And Linklater basically just got some friends together, and they just, it's very similar kind of to what Nolan did with Following, where it was like they just met on weekends and filmed it with Following, and then Linklater was very similar. And it went far in the festival circuit, and people it started getting a lot of acclaim and a lot of buzz. I don't think it's particularly good, but it's definitely interesting. It's basically one conversation leads to another conversation leads to another conversation amongst different groups of people. I don't find any of the people particularly interesting, but I admired the fact that he did that and managed to pull it off in a way that clearly people responded to.
Would you say that he's sort of a descendant then in a sense of Altman?
You know, I haven't seen any of Altman's films.
Okay.
So,
because Altman was sort of known for that.
Was it Nashville that he did? I hear Nashville very much like kind of not episodic, but kind of a mosaic. Is that the right word? Of just different vignettes of people living in the city.
I mean, even the original MASH is kind of like that, where it's in Korea and it's a commentary on society and everything, but it's not really. It's not what the TV show was, which was like, look at these zany people doing things while they save lives. You know, like it wasn't that. It was very loose, and Altman's movies tended to be pretty. Like, I think The Player is the only one where he really, and I'm sure that there are film fans that are like, but I'm not terribly versed in Altman, but my impression was with The Player was where he sort of like, when Lucas was like, I'm going to make Star Wars because I want to do something that's an exercise in plot. And like, The Player is the one, everybody loves The Player.
Right.
Right. You've seen The Player. Haven't you?
So, I mean,
you should.
I honestly don't think I've seen anything by Altman, and I should. You're absolutely right. Because I hear very interesting things that intrigue me about him. So Slacker did very well, and it actually got him a deal with Universal for Dazed and Confused, which was, you know, supposed to be his Hollywood feature.
Yeah.
And the experience was horrible for him. The movie did not make money. It was, the marketing was purposely kind of skewed to just bury it. They didn't really understand what he was doing. He didn't particularly love working in the studio system. He kind of was excited about it, but his experience afterwards with getting the film made. They never interfered with it, but it was just a constant headache of like, well, we don't understand, da, 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 and then a very clear disinterest in the film. So it was a negative experience for him. It eventually, you know, it has a cult following. It's very beloved now. Like I said, yeah. I'm not a huge fan. And then Before Sunrise was his third film, and it was just kind of outside the studio system. He just had a couple million dollars, and he had this idea. He had met a woman on a bus in Philadelphia. And
that most stories don't end well, start that way.
I think he had taken the bus to Philadelphia, and he met this, he got off and he was just kind of feeling like, I'm in this new place. I'm kind of excited. Slacker was doing very well in the award, the festival circuit. So he was just very like upbeat, and he met this woman in a toy store. She worked at a toy store, and they kind of hit it off. Hmm. And they ended up, when she got off work, they kind of walked around Philadelphia and just sort of talked to each other. And he was, during that experience, he was like, I want to capture this feeling of you meet somebody, you're strangers, but there's a connection, and just that feeling of elation, that kind of elusive feeling that you get when you meet someone and truly connect with them. And that was the basis for Before Sunrise. And he wrote a script, and he wrote it with Kim Krasan, whose work he admired, and he wanted a female voice to kind of come in to play the counterpart. Mm-hmm. And then for a while, he wasn't sure what to do with it because he couldn't find the right people. And eventually he got Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, the two stars. And they kind of actually, even though they're not credited, they rewrote his script and kind of gave it their input. He knew they were both writers. He was excited by the prospect that they seemed like very excited and creative about the whole process. And it was they essentially took the script and rewrote it, made it their own. And that's basically what happened. And Before Sunrise was a very small movie. It came out in 1994. I think it was January 1995 was when it was released.
95.
Yep.
Okay. Why was I under the impression this came out in 99?
Because you are...
I'm wrong, obviously.
Because this is a moment that needed to be recorded. You being wrong and me accepting and just moving past it.
You're most gracious.
But being very happy that it was caught on
very, very gracious.
On the internet.
If you don't edit this out, I'm going to... well, I know where you live.
There you go. So, but, you know, the movie came out. It was, like I said, it was about a $2 million budget. It made around like $4 or $5 million. It wasn't a huge hit by any means. And but it again, kind of developed a little cult following.
Now, here's a question for you. This is a fave.
Sure.
Right? You love this film.
Yeah.
The whole premise of Missing Frames is you or somebody else has never seen what's going to be up on the screen.
Right.
You've seen this. You obviously have a positive opinion of it. Going into this, is there any more of a nervous reaction about me watching this?
Absolutely. This is, I think, I showed E.T. to Lindsay and Brandon in the third episode, and that was, I mean, E.T. is one of my favorite movies, but E.T. is almost so popular and so, like, mainstream. Is, I feel like that's such a pretentious descriptor, but it's a mainstream popular movie, and I wanted them to love it. I was happy they loved it, but that was something where I felt like if they didn't love it, I was gonna be okay. If you don't love this, there's no hope for me.
Oh, well, that sounds like an invitation to hate.
No, but this is a very unconventional movie, and particularly this movie, I think, says something because it is essentially two people talking throughout the whole movie. There is no pizzazz.
Are they podcasters?
They're basically podcasters. This is the advent of podcasting is this movie. It's historically why I wanted to have this movie on our podcast. Because it's very close to my heart, and because it's a very unique movie and there isn't a lot like it.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily know how you'll react to it.
Okay.
And I want you to like it just because obviously I love it and I want you to enjoy it. I don't want you to hate yourself, though I wouldn't be that upset if you did. But also I think part of the beauty of this movie is its sequels and what they have to say about relationships.
So there's a before connected universe is what you're telling me.
Exactly.
Are there ancillary comic books?
There are going to be crossovers, and Scanner Darkly is eventually going to make its way in. And everyone's
it goes animated
be,
for like 5 minutes and you don't know what's happening.
Everyone's going to be rotoscoped and it's going to be great. but Before Sunrise is... Before Sunrise, it was intended as a standalone movie. It was never intended to have sequels. So it is kind of... it could function on its own terms, and it should function on its own terms, and the other two should be kind of taken as pleasant surprises. But yeah, I mean, there's always a nervousness with showing somebody sure. something you are like totally in love with and not being sure how they'll feel about it. You know, right. I remember I tried to show my wife, Sarah, I tried to show her Seven Samurai, which is another one of my favorite movies. Mm-hmm. And about 30 minutes in, she just wasn't feeling it. And she's like, I'm ready for bed. And I was so devastated and so upset. And it was ridiculous. I acted like a child, like a petulant child. And I kind of stomped off and was like, you know, but it was so funny because it was just what I think what I didn't like was there was a lack of. Like from the beginning, it was almost like and to no fault of her own, I personally was like, oh, you didn't even try to watch it, and da da da. And I felt very high and mighty and very like self-righteous about
it. Yeah,
but you know, that was tough because it was when you show somebody something that you love that you have declared this is one of my favorite things, you're basically saying this is something that is a representation of a part of me,
right?
And when somebody, you have to kind of disconnect from the reaction emotionally that the person has, because you have to remember, and I have a problem with this, you have to remember it's not an attack on you, it's just they don't necessarily connect to it the way you do.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, a lot of times I've had issues where I've showed somebody something and they've been like, whatever, and I've been like, okay, well, screw you. You're not, you know, whatever. And I, you'll never get it. But
no, you have like a little mental checkboard, you know, or checkboard. You have a little notebook where you're sitting there, and you give a little check mark, and you're just like, okay, this person has no taste.
Exactly. All right. But like, do you have an experience like that where you like we're kind of in a similar situation?
Tons. I mean, you know, it would be to belabor the whole thing that like I was, you know, at times the lone voice in the wilderness, loving the Phantom Menace in my circle of friends. That was very difficult because a lot of the attacks, because so many people associate Star Wars with me, they did get personal.
Yeah.
Where, like they said horrible things about me because I liked it. Yeah. I was like, I just liked it. Why? But, and I've told the story before, so I'll tell a truncated version, but Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it holds a special place in many people's hearts.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, the nerd community, right?
Of course.
And I grew up with Star Trek II, and, you know, I still cry at the end of it a lot of times and stuff like that. And when my wife and I, Agent Bun, first started going, I was like, you've never seen Star Trek II? She's like, I don't like Star Trek. I'm like, no, this is beyond Star Trek.
Right.
And she took a phone call from a friend of hers during the movie. And then she like fell asleep before the end. Ugh. And I swear to you, it still ranks in the list of moments where I almost walked away from the relationship because I was so, it wasn't even that it was a personal thing. It was, how dare you show disrespect to a work of art? Like, I mean, you might as well go up and like, you know, be like, it's like the Joker in the art museum, you know, where yes. he like starts painting on the Monet. It's like, what are you doing? You know, I mean, I would say that there, to speak to your point of having to disconnect from it, I think that over time you do. Like I have, there's actually one movie where it has so many positive personal emotions tied to it, as well as a love of musicals and especially filmed musicals that I take it very, I don't show it to people and I very sparsely recommend it, but it's Scrooge, the 1970 or 71, whatever, Albert Finney adaptation.
Okay.
It's a musical. And it is an absolute joy. I consider it perfect. There's not a single thing with it that is wrong.
Okay.
Ever. And so I have a hard time even recommending it because not only is it perfect and wonderful, but we used to watch it all the time growing up. And and one of the songs in it was like my dad's favorite. So like if you don't like it, you know, you're insulting my family if you don't like it, you know, that sort of thing. So, but that said, please, everybody go out and watch it. Just don't tell me if you don't like it.
Exactly. You know? So, all right. So we've kind of both talked about how we feel about Linklater. I mean, obviously, I'm a fan. You are kind of, you've seen Dazed and Confused, weren't a big fan. School of Rock you liked, which is
very much
not, School of Rock is really great, but not necessarily representative of Linklater. That's not the one I would go to as like, this is Linklater, his essence.
Sure.
But so how do you feel about Before Sunrise right now as far as watching it goes? Like just disconnected from everything I've said.
I'm intrigued.
Level of interest?
I'm intrigued because enough people have said positive things about it that I'm, you know, it's like, oh, maybe there's something there. You know, like I'm interested. I'm intrigued. it's one of those movies where I think that you could very easily say, you know, you always have in the back of your mind, it's like, oh, I should see that. Oh, I should see that. It's 10:30 in Futurama's on, you know, and like, so you watch that instead sort of thing. But right. I've had a curiosity to see it for a while. So I'm actually glad to finally get around to it.
Well, great. I'm glad we can do this for you. With that, I'm going to stop talking. And I think we should just go ahead and get to watching this shindig.
Sounds good.
Now available to own on video cassette.
All right, we are back, and we just finished the movie. And first and foremost, for anyone listening, I don't usually do this. I haven't done this on any of our episodes. I want to encourage anyone who has not seen this movie to tune out of this conversation because, frankly, I think this movie should not be spoiled. If you don't know anything about it, if you are interested in watching it, you really should see it first. And then come back and we'll still be here. We're going to be here on the internet forever.
I'm actually never going to let Sean leave.
Tied
He's
to
going
the
to
chair.
Be trapped here forever.
It's not a joke.
Don't
please.
Forget, you're here forever.
All right. Well, John, so very interested to hear your opinion. What did you think of Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise?
Well, we walked right in here because my exact words, I don't want to spoil my reaction.
Right. For the people at home, a lot of the times we really try to get to our recording equipment as quickly as possible.
Yeah,
without saying anything, because we want to kind of spontaneously react.
If this film were a person, I would hold it and love it and adore it for all time.
This makes me so happy.
This is an absolute masterpiece. I was moved almost to the point of tears several times. There was genuine laughter, and I can tell you, because you said this came out in 1995, I am of an age where there was a lot of it that resonated for various different reasons.
Of course.
And it was, I think that it is absolutely brilliant and wonderful. And I know that makes, from some points of view, it doesn't make for exceptional listening to hear somebody not have it. I don't have a single complaint with this film.
Wow.
I don't have a single anything about this to say except, oh my gosh, I can't believe it took me. Like, there were legitimately moments where I felt like I had traveled back in time.
Yeah.
And was experiencing something familiar again. And I, you know, there you go. That's my reaction to this.
I'm extremely happy you enjoyed it so much. And I think that's what is so special about this movie. And as I mentioned beforehand, this movie, you know, we know it's a trilogy, spoiler alert, but originally this movie was just made spontaneously.
As we were talking
about in the before section, we discussed that, Linklater really wanted to capture that feeling of meeting someone spontaneously and the feeling of just that pure love you feel when you find someone you truly feel that connection with.
And that is precisely what he succeeded in doing.
Yeah.
There were so many moments where, it resonated, but I felt everybody can remember the moments in their life where they met a person where in that moment they said, there's something here.
Yeah.
Something is happening. And there are a handful of people. I'm married to one where that happened. And a lot of people, I mean, I grew up in a family where the conception was that my dad met my mom. He'd never fallen in love with, it was a very sweet sort of storybook story that they gave to us.
Sure.
But at the same time, as I grew older, I was like, that's a bunch of bunk. Right. And like the performances in this are unreal to me, not in the sense that I don't believe in them, but they're unreal in the sense that I forgot I was watching Ethan Hawke.
Yeah.
I'll double back to that, but to have a film that I know has been written beforehand and rehearsed and set up, because you don't just turn on a camera and go, you know, like, yes, you can do that with films, but it felt like I was watching real life. This was like a documentary of two people that I believed really existed, what they were experiencing at the time. And I realized after it was over that Ethan Hawke so many times in his career has given a performance where I've walked out of it and just, he's blown me, but he's never one of those, you know, people talk about DiCaprio and people talk about Daniel Day-Lewis and stuff like that. And maybe Ethan Hawke isn't out there, you know, putting on 50 pounds and playing Jake LaMotta right. or, you know, as a retired right. boxer yeah. or something. But this, Gattaca, Training Day, mm-hmm. all of these things. And this is another one of those performances where it's just, it's mind melting. And Julie Delpy too.
Yeah.
My word. I can't, I mean, obviously, I, you know, and I know I'm like just blah, 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 jibber jabbering.
Please
on
do. I mean, this is like, I have to listen to myself say this so often. It's very nice to hear somebody yeah, else saying it.
I can't believe, and the camera work, the improv feel. I mean, it was obvious when they met the two Germans that there was a little bit of improv going
yeah,
on there.
Like, yeah.
You know, but that's what made it work.
Right.
It sold the whole concept to
and
me.
And, you know, you speak of improv. What's shocking to many people about these movies is I'm sure there is a little bit of improv, like you were saying. You can kind of tell when it gets a little.
Yeah.
But for the most part, Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy, and Richard Linklater insist that there is almost no improv. That even the little twerk, like the perks and the ticks and the interrupting yeah. each other and the pauses, all of it is meticulously rehearsed. So the fact that it's exhausting enough to create that energy and that spontaneity
right.
In a performance, to do it over and over and over again, and like literally, like you say, something that is so stunning about this film and its sequels, you don't feel like you're watching a movie. You feel like you've beamed in on a place and time with two
right.
very, very real people. And it's
right.
that's not an accident. That's not something that just, oh, all the pieces, everything aligned, the stars aligned. That this is an insane piece of work to be able to capture
sure.
a moment so transcendent, but also to do it in a way, when I tell people about this movie, you can kind of see their eyes glaze over. Oh, two young people who are in love
right.
and talking to each other. And for them to capture that and to make you feel and to
mm-hmm.
make you invest in a movie that is literally two people walking and talking the entire time is
yeah.
astonishing to me that somebody was able to pull that off.
You know, it's what's especially interesting is it does exist in a time that's, you know, proto Seinfeldian. People got used to the idea of the show about nothing, but only as like sort of like a riff. This is two people walking and talking, but there is so much happening.
Yeah.
In terms of how they're interacting. And there are so many, you know, there are so many stolen moments in it. And I think that a film like this is especially critical in times like I would not be alone, I think, in saying that there is an incredible cynicism that exists. I think that this
yeah.
is before the internet really came into play.
Right.
And
it's, I love that it captures it. It does capture that moment,
right?
Where a connection with somebody, me growing up, the majority of my romantic relationships were sparked by the internet. You know, it was
right.
with, like, I could have conversations with somebody I just met and immediately take off. What I love about this movie is it captures a moment where you did not have that option, where there was the possibility that you could meet someone
right.
and never see them again and never speak to them again.
And not only were you there in a limited capacity in a limited amount of time, but whether you had the connection was evident.
And no distraction. You don't have a phone where you can
correct.
Get out of that moment.
Absolutely correct. And what's truly wonderful about it is what it really does recapture is a moment like meeting my wife,
right?
Where we met speed dating,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, seriously though, you know, a lot of people say, "Oh, speed dating," you know, or they say, "Oh, that's weird," but that is like that encapsulates this
because yeah.
even though it's a bunch of people, you had to know immediately whether there was a connection, whether
mm-hmm.
there was any chemistry at all, and I don't think it can be overstated that so many wonderful things happen in that. In a split second,
yeah.
in just a snap. And the simple decision to sit down next to him causes all of this.
Yeah.
Whereas it would have been easy, you know, and I know it sounds grumpy old man-ish, but it's not meant to. But I can't help but think, okay, you're on that train and the couple's having the argument. You put on your headphones and turn on your iPhone
yep.
and you play
yeah.
or you go on Twitter.
Very good
and
point.
And you don't move.
Yep. That's a very, very good point.
What are we missing now?
Yeah. And it is kind of sad that we don't get that a lot anymore. And, you know, I even though I said a lot of my relationships, a lot of romances I've had in my life have been sparked by encounters with people who I've met, like kind of maintaining that on the internet. I have, believe it or not, I've been alive long enough to remember a time where Facebook still wasn't a thing.
Right.
We still didn't have an easy way to connect with people.
Right.
In like the way that Facebook and social networking provides. So I had the gift of that kind of spontaneous relationship where it was very self-contained and you were very in the moment and you weren't sure what was going to happen afterwards.
Well, even think about this, taking it out of the romantic realm.
Yeah.
Right. How many friendships have started?
Right.
I have, obviously we're podcasting and you know, on the Nerd Party Network, there are a ton of us who have never actually met in person. We've never actually existed within the same room. And I count some of the people on this network as some of the dearest friends I have in my life.
Absolutely.
Right now. But you and me all starts with, who's this weird kid that's sitting over there? Is he a threat to my job?
Who hates The Dark Knight Rises and hates the prequels.
Exactly.
Right.
How am I going to curb stomp this new hire? I have to lure him out into
Edward
the parking
lot.
Yes. I have to lure him into the parking lot. But seriously though, when you have that first initial conversation and you're like, huh, okay, this person.
Yeah.
We could work this out. You know, like, and there's you know, I'll make reference to because you know you're friends with him too in person, Craig.
Yep.
Who you know, we co-host Wars with Nerds and everything, but like he and I, our first meeting was arranged by a mutual friend who, you know, and we've told the story a billion times, but like Craig's one of my dearest friends, and you know, he had trolled me on the internet because you know he knew who I was and all of that stuff because I had the blog and all of these things. But then we met in person and didn't stop talking from that moment forward.
Right.
Like it was, hey, this is Craig.
You spent
like,
a romantic Craig. Evening in Vienna walking around.
We have spent many romantic evenings in Vienna walking around.
Vienna, Virginia.
Yes. Drunk is a key here. We don't have to beg for a bottle of wine. We're drunk by the time we get to the bar. but I mean that's the thing is like those so many friendships. I mean, you know what? I'll go back to one of my oldest friends of long standing, two of them. Okay, because I know that both of them listen on occasion, so I want to make sure they don't feel left out. But my buddy Joey, we were in drama club together,
right?
And but we were sent off on some task because, you know, we're a private school and like, oh, well, you know, you don't have to rehearse your scene. You have to go up and help somebody. It's like that's just what happens in high school. Right. You like Star Wars? Yeah. Star Wars is pretty cool. But roll it back to my friend Mike.
Uh-huh.
We have mutual friends. We're gathered in the hallway freshman year of high school. So you like The Doors? Hey, I got a book you can read. Boom. And, you know, decades later, here you are. And it's okay. Again, I know I'm going on, but that's the type of feeling that this captures.
Even
above and beyond the romantic. But the romantic thing, to get romance to work on this level on screen, chemistry is insane.
In a way that doesn't feel pandering there's not a single false note in it. And it's a very... people who have complained about this movie, what little complaints there are that are lobbied against this movie, a lot of people have said, you know, it's almost a little too like magical, the moment and the evening
baloney.
They spend together.
Complete baloney.
I agree. And what this movie does very well is it captures that moment. And even if the things that are happening seem very idealistic, it's because one, that's the age they were, that's the feelings they have. And I see every character they encounter, every person they speak with, as filtered through their feelings of this is the night to end all nights. This is the big moment in my life. So everything is kind of exaggerated and given that flourish. Now, without spoiling anything about the sequels kind of deconstruct this movie a little bit in a way that is completely respectful and enriches each one enriches the previous one.
Okay.
In a way that kind of hurts you, but makes you appreciate it all the more. But
interesting.
I don't want to talk about sequels too much because I want you to experience.
Well, I can
them,
guarantee you that I am going to watch.
Oh, that makes me so happy. But
I can guarantee, gosh darn, tee that. But the thing is, in terms of that, you know, quote unquote magical moment, I actually there's a night that I always remember. Nothing came of it. We didn't spend the night together. Nothing like that.
Yeah.
But I was at a party, my buddy was going to college up near Baltimore or whatever, and there was a girl and. You know, I was sort of like, well, hey, and there was drinking and everything. And for some reason at the time I was fluent in German and she was fluent in Spanish. And so we started trying to figure out what the other person was saying. And we had this and it was fun. And we just had this conversation. Yeah. And there was a little spark there. And yeah, it went away. But at the very least, I didn't sit in the corner and wonder what would it have been like to talk to
exactly.
this girl. And I have this story so many years later to say, yeah, I actually had a conversation where I kind of understood what was going on. And I was speaking German and she was speaking Spanish and it was kind of funny.
I have a similar situation and I don't know if I've told you this. Did I tell you how I discovered these movies?
No.
The before movies?
No.
It's a very interesting story and very relevant. So the year after I graduated from high school, I was living in the area going to community college and my old high school got foreign exchange students. And I was so upset because I was like, they never did anything like that when I was there. And this is ridiculous. Why? That's not fair. But I was so intrigued by the idea of meeting. I'd never met anyone like that lived that was in another country. I was like another culture, people that like have no like it's like I this is amazing. So I like went out of my way to meet these Austrian foreign exchange students. And I fell hopelessly in love with some poor girl who had to deal with me pining after. But it was nothing like this movie. Nothing like, I mean, she could barely understand English. I was too shy to really talk with her. But there was definitely something. We could tell like there was something like, regardless of how shallow it was, there was some mutual understanding and interest in each other. And it was a very profound moment in my life. A couple years later, I got the opportunity. It wasn't just her. I made friends, and a couple years later, I had the opportunity to go to Austria with a friend of mine and to see this girl and see our friends there. And the night before I went, I was talking to a really good friend of mine, Tommy, and was just chatting with him and saying like, "Yeah, this is what I'm doing, and I'm so excited," and da da da. And I'd written everything about my encounter with this girl in this story form. And this is, you know, I'm into writing and I love writing. And one of my biggest things has been trying to figure out how can I take my experiences in real life and translate them into a narrative that would be interesting to someone other than myself.
Yeah.
And you know, I was telling him about that and how I was excited to see this girl and who knew what would happen. And he goes, "That sounds exactly like Before Sunrise." And I say, "I have no idea what that is." And he explains it to me. He's like, "Before Sunrise and Before Sunset," because this is 2006, and those were the only two that were out at the time.
Okay.
And he was like, "It's this, that." As he's talking to me, I'm kind of cynically like, "Okay, cool." And I'm looking it up on Rotten Tomatoes because I'm a brat like that. I'm like, "Sure, Before Sunrise." I look up Before Sunrise. It has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I'm like, "Oh, I should watch this." And, you know, Before Sunset, I think, had like 95-96%. So it was like, "Oh, okay."
You know what's especially beautiful about this conversation that we're having is, yeah, we're talking about the film, but we're not talking about the film. And for me, that is something that really speaks to when a film transcends and becomes a piece of art, is when you're not just talking about the film.
Oh, totally.
But you're saying, yeah, I can relate to it because, and I can understand it because, and if I were to run across Richard Linklater, Ethan Hawke, or Julie Delpy, the first thing I would do is, unprompted, give them a hug and say
and big old kiss and tap on the fanny
and say thank you for making that.
Yeah,
this because
absolutely. You're completely right. It is
amazing.
That's what I love about the movie, is it fires up feelings in people every time I show it to somebody who really connects to it.
Yeah.
And I've been showing it to coworkers, as I was telling you before the show, and I kind of passed the movie to one person who then passed along to another coworker. We'd all watched the first movie, or I mean, I'd seen it already, but we just sat down in a room together and just kind of talked about like that. And it was just like,
yes,
this is what I love about this movie, is that. But before I get off, I'm going to finish the story real quick and then let's get back to this topic.
Okay.
But so basically the next day, the flight, that was the day of my flight to Austria.
Okay.
I went out and bought Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and a portable DVD player. And I watched both of them back to back on the plane to Austria. And It was insane. But then we also went to Vienna during our stay there. Oh, that's crazy.
Saw
the Ferris wheel. I saw it, it was just like, and we're with the girl that I'm, you know, in madly in love with. And it was just like, this is, it was so strange. That was my first viewing of the movies.
You know what? I just remembered a memory that this triggered all the way back to high school. Is I was part of the speech and debate team.
Okay.
Shocker. Okay. And and we would go on these trips, and we went to, I want to say it was Villanova up in Philadelphia or something like that. And one of the other visiting teams was from upstate New York. And there was a girl, I think her name was Julie at the time.
Okay.
But every time we were not in a room performing, because I was the speech side, debate. Yeah, I mean, I think everybody knows I can argue pretty well. But the, it was the duo interpretation and stuff like that. And every time that we weren't in, like, to put it another way, by the end of the speech and debate meet, she was wearing my sport coat. That I, you know, and like we were, and we tried to talk by phone and stuff like, I think I still have like her high school picture or something like that. But you know, in like an old photo album or something, but this is like that,
totally
that again. And I know we keep talking about these stories that
it's funny
that they remind
us about. It's funny how this movie brings that out. And, but as you were saying, it does, it brings out those feelings. Like I said, sitting in a room with my coworkers and just talking about like this movie and what it makes you feel. And, I want to, because we've talked a lot about our own experiences. So I really want to hone in on the movie itself.
Yeah.
There's a moment where Celine tells Jesse, where she's like, you know, I believe if there's any magic or any kind of God, it's about this. Yeah. It's not in any of us, but it's the space in between with people trying to understand each other, which is a lot of what we're talking about. What this movie kind of inspires in people is to connect. So at what moment when watching this movie did you feel that connection with the film? Like when did you start to, because, you know, the movie, it starts off kind of, you're meeting these people, they're meeting each other. So what was the point where you kind of started to feel the connection of like, okay, this is a movie where it's going to be two people talking the whole time and I'm going to be okay with this?
Honestly, the point where I first felt okay with it was in the very beginning, the first time when the waiter brings the menus and it pulled back and then it cuts to the end, it felt like end date one, date two.
Yeah.
It was an act break. And when they came back, I found myself legitimately intrigued. I wanted to know what happened next.
Yeah.
And that's the spark, the seal, like the absolute stamp where this wasn't just a film I was really enjoying, but a film that I would use the word adore to speak about was when they were on the boat and they had that conversation on the boat. That's where it elevated from film I really enjoy to wow,
right,
this is the real, this is I'm putting this on my list of films that I think everybody needs to see.
Yeah. And what I love about that scene, the movie, you don't really, there's no urgency to the movie for the
right.
most part. It's a very, they're talking to each other and you're kind of just like, this is great. I love watching these people. I'm so interested in what they're saying. I love the way they're connecting with each other. And what I love is they don't even think about it. And then that moment is when they finally acknowledge what's happening. And they're like, you realize we're probably never going to see each other again. And
right.
suddenly the movie, you're interested, but everything is enriched and it clicks. Now there's urgency. Now there's a
It's
conflict.
A race against time.
And it's funny that the yeah. conflict of the movie comes an hour and 12 minutes into the runtime. And that's okay. It doesn't
yeah.
matter. But, it does. Then it actually has that moment. It's interesting that you picked that because it's like it's the moment where it definitely starts to
well,
feel
that
like,
moment's so earned.
Yeah.
It is really earned because it builds to that moment. And in that moment is a moment that everybody can relate to, that no matter what you're doing, no matter where you are, when you're having a great time, when you're having a special time, there is that moment where you suddenly realize, oh, this is going to end.
Yep.
This is going to come. You're at the amusement park. You're having a great time. And then the sun starts setting. And the first thought in your head is, I'm going to have to go home.
Right.
Sometime. I can stretch this out until the park closes, but I'm going to have to go home.
Exactly.
And it's that little moment where you have to make peace and say, I'm going to have a good time anyway. And in terms of capturing the moment, I have not shared this story with too many people.
Okay.
But I'll share it with you and perfect. With the entire internet right now. That scene with the poet where he says, give me a word and I'll write a poem for you. Not exactly the same thing, but there was a girl that I dated that is the first girl that I could legitimately say I had fallen in love with in my life. And it was in college and we had broken up and I was despondent. Like there was that real connection. I was really unhappy. We decided to bury the hatchet, right? Which is, I mean, you know, which is basically like code for we're going to try to get back together.
Sure.
But, you know, you're young. You don't realize that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Sometimes. But we get together to bury the hatchet. We go to a coffee house. Yes, an actual coffee house in Fells Point in Baltimore. And we're walking back to the car and we're being very clear. No, we're not getting back together. We're not getting back together. We're just two friends talking, Mm-hmm. And there's a guy who says, you know, I'm homeless. And he sees like the face. He's like, I'm not going to ask you for money. And he said, I actually wish I was a singer. And he said, I'll sing part of one of three songs to you. And if you like it, feel free to give me some money. It was just like that.
Yeah.
The song he sang was actually Open Arms by Journey. He sang two verses of it.
Uh-huh.
And I wound up giving him like a five because I was like, you know what? You actually have a good voice.
Right.
And that was real. I appreciate that. And he said, thank you, man. And he looked at the two of us. He said, you two are going to get married. And she and I laughed. We were like, ha, ha, ha. And then we got back together the next day.
That's amazing.
We broke up again, obviously. But, you know,
I love that. And I just love that this movie, what film does is it captures a moment. And I truly believe this without hyperbole. I don't think any filmmaker understands, quote unquote, the moment better than Richard Linklater. As this movie proves, as the sequels to this movie prove,
yeah.
As Boyhood proves, you know, it is something.
I'll take the hint and see it finally.
I gave it to you.
No, this
2 years ago.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
And it's still in the shrink wrap. But the thing is, this has convinced me. I've got to see that now.
Yeah,
absolutely. Like, this is the type of movie where if I see Richard Linklater's name, he did this movie.
Yeah,
I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I don't think any other movie. I love Boyhood, and I love Everybody Wants Some, and I love Waking Life, and you know, I'm obviously a huge fan. But I think the Before trilogy stands alone. Even in his incredible filmography, even against Boyhood, as a singular accomplishment, and it's amazing. I mean, it is a definitive statement on the passage of time.
Yeah.
What romance, what love truly means. I go so far as to call this series maybe the definitive cinematic depiction of love.
Wow.
And I really, it sucks again. As I was saying beforehand, and I wonder if you could respond to this, I hate saying things like that. I'm obsessed. I mean, obviously, I love these movies. They're very near and dear to me. But I hate talking about it. And why I try to convince, you know, say, throw up a spoiler tag. You can't talk about this movie and hype it up like this without somebody going and being like, all right, Before Sunrise. Oh,
yes.
So boring.
It's completely agree with you.
I struggle to not. Oh my God! Freak out about this
you don't,
movie.
You don't want to oversell it,
right? Because it's a movie that doesn't deserve that. It shouldn't be oversold. Its
right.
beauty is its simplicity. Same as
completely
agree. Same as Boyhood, and Boyhood had a very strong backlash during Oscars, as most great movies do. We have seen it most recently with La La Land, where people have gone crazy against that movie.
Yeah, people
for being happy. You know, Boyhood.
Please, Boyhood
got kind of attacked for like nothing happens in the movie, and I was like, "That's the point."
I actually saw, and the thing is, I didn't like Zootopia. I thought it was middling at best. But to speak to the backlash thing, I saw on Twitter somebody actually did, as part of the backlash, you know, somebody said, "I finally saw Zootopia. It's very racist," and I was like, "It's the most anti-racist movie I've seen."
Yeah.
Years.
At what point does
I'm curious as to how you came up with that reaction.
Right. But like, and this does not just apply to this movie in a vacuum.
Right.
But like with any movie, there's the danger of it's my favorite film of all time. Now it has that expectation set up against it.
Yeah. And it's very real. It's why whenever I speak to certain friends, I actually have a pact with a couple of friends where all I am allowed to say is, should I see it?
Yeah.
You know, like because if I give more of a reaction, they know they will have their expectations tempered or, you know, set too high or something mm-hmm. like that. Like if I come out of something, I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why I try to temper things. And I'm just saying that to say I'm with you on that.
Sure.
That I would not want to oversell this film, because if I did, I know that I'm screwing its chances at being received with certain people.
Sure, exactly. Okay, so, you know, directed by Richard Linklater, written by Richard Linklater with Kim Krasan. No. What's interesting about this movie, Kim Krasan and Richard Linklater are credited as the co-writers, but Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke did rewrite the script, and they're not credited on this movie. However, they are credited on the sequels, and Kim Krasan is credited as based on the story and based on characters Before Sunrise, but she's not credited in the other ones. Lee Daniel is the cinematographer for this. He did the first two movies and strangely did not do the third movie. Now, are you familiar? Do you know anything Lee Daniel has done other than
this? I'm familiar with the name.
He's worked with Linklater a lot.
Okay.
And it's just so interesting that he didn't, I don't know what happened. I don't know if there's a story there, but he worked on the first two movies, but not Before Midnight. Now, Before Midnight does have kind of a distinct visual feel apart from these two movies, but they all are very similar in terms of the walk and talk format.
But see, that's interesting to me because one of my big questions when Interstellar came out was Pfister didn't work on that with
sure.
Nolan. And you said Daniel usually works with Linklater. And Interstellar still looked and felt like a Nolan film.
Yeah.
Did that come across with Before Midnight, or is there any sort of, you know what? Unless you think it ruins it.
I won't tell
you
specifically
that.
What I think is amazing about Link, and some would argue like, yeah, so he doesn't really do anything, which I think is complete BS. But what I love about this series of movies is how unobtrusive he is. You don't think about camera work. You don't think about what's happening. He is so good at recognizing the moment and just there it is. And cut the way he edits the movie, the way he shows, he'll cut to a wide shot showing them like just in the midst of this beautiful city and knowing exactly the right moment when to pull back. And like we've left that moment. And now we can pull back is it's incredible filmmaking.
I think the best example of that that jumps to mind in this film is when they go into the listening booth.
Yeah,
because the camera angle switches to something that isn't really used throughout the rest of the film. And you can detect that that is the moment where they're both deciding, I'm committing to this.
Yeah,
this isn't just a fun thing anymore. I'm actually
feeling
experiencing
something. Yeah.
Something. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, again, there are so many just unbroken takes, like the scene where they first get on the bus and there's this long extended take of them just talking to each other. And I love at the end when he's like, let's get off this damn bus, because you sense that's not just the character, but also Ethan Hawke just being like, we've literally been sitting here and talking, you know, it's great. And, but there's so many moments like that where, like we were saying, it feels improvised, it feels spontaneous. And I cannot give enough credit to Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy for that. It is an astonishing thing to portray life in a way that feels genuine without feeling pretentious even. That's one of the most shocking things. These two people, they're like two 24-year-olds at like on the cusp of experiencing, like, you know, they're open-minded, and they talk about things that could sound pretentious if we were to try to explain it.
Yeah.
But never once do you feel like they're talking down to anybody or talking. And it's part of it is the nature of the two people want to impress each other. So they are very open and honest with each other. But it's also the fact that they're willing to, like, she's very like, you know, I'm a feminist and I da da da. But she's also very willing to admit like, no, but even though I say these things, I want that vulnerability and I want to feel loved. And
right.
It's the fact that it goes beyond just pretentious, like, oh, ideas and da da da. As the movie goes on, it starts with you getting the sense that they're both trying to kind of impress each other with like, oh, look how smart I am. But the walls come down. And before long, they realize like we're connecting on a much deeper level, and we're still talking about ideas, but it's beyond like, I'm trying to impress you with this cool idea I came up with for a TV show that is 24 hours a day and you just watch people, you know, it,
yeah.
It's now like, you know, I feel like, you know, in my life, I would rather do something amazing than be in a loving relationship. You know, it's like all of a sudden we're getting into very deep, profound territory.
Well, and I think at the core of the entire film is the fact that they're together by choice. There's nothing in this film that is a cheap ploy to keep the characters together.
Yeah.
There's no big explosive argument where she runs off and then she comes back and says,
yeah,
I've reconsidered. There's nothing like that. And they, you know, so like everything is about a choice, which is the way I guess love should be.
Yeah, it's the way it's
all about I'm choosing to be with you. It's not because I need to. It's not because I can't live without you. It's because I want to.
Sure. And it's the way a lot of movies feel the need, and it's hard. I mean, in my writing, I've tried to do this and I've struggled with it. A lot of movies are, you know, you get the script for this movie and a producer looks at it and says nothing's happening.
Right.
People are talking, you know, it is a movie that is not conventional in the slightest. And as we said, the true conflict does not come until about an hour and 20 minutes into the movie when they realize like, oh, we might not ever see each other again. What are we going to do? And suddenly there's a ticking clock on it. For the majority of the movie, there is no ticking clock. It's literally just enjoying being in these people's presence, like getting to be a fly on the wall and watch them interact with each other, because this movie is about the a feeling. It goes beyond like you said, just the cliched notions of it. It's smarter than that. It doesn't want to throw in a moment where like, oh, we have a something horrible happened, or I got a call and my grandma has died. You know,
I have to
make
the decision whether to go see my sick mother or stay with you.
Exactly. And that's what I love about it. You know, the fact that that Linklater, Ethan Hawke, and Julie Delpy were brave enough to do that. And there's a funny story where Julie Delpy, they had shot a little bit, and I think they were watching footage, and Julie Delpy's like, oh my God, this is so boring. Like we're just talking and we've got to get someone to come in and write jokes for us and just pep it up a little bit and just make, you know, nobody's going to want to see this. And Richard Linklater sat her down and he said, Julie, I've been listening to you guys talk for like a few days now, and not once have I been bored. If somebody is bored by this, that's not my audience. They're not our audience.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that he recognizes that. And that makes sense now, because you said before we watched it, like how unhappy he was in the studio system makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And it's because that's not his style of thinking. And that statement alone completely reflects it. Like it reflects a comfort on the part of an artist to say, if they don't like what I'm doing, what we're doing, okay.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, like that's, you know what, that's the spirit of it. That's what makes it work.
And I love that, because it's also not, I'm so brilliant. It's not Linklater saying I'm the genius behind this. He wrote a script with Kim Krasan and gave it to Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. And Julie Delpy looked at it and was like, frankly, this isn't very romantic and I wouldn't say these things. And Ethan was kind of like, yeah, same here. And instead of being like, well, it's written and this is the Bible, you have to quote it, Richard Linklater said, all right, well, what would you say? What would you do? And that's why these movies are so special. It's a collaboration between the three of them. And Linklater is just the one who's like, okay, and now I'm the one who's basically going to capture this.
Yeah.
And I'm going to capture it in the best, most effective way possible. But I love that it is a collaboration, and that he recognizes that you need that input from other people. It's not a singular vision. It's part of this community and communication with each other.
Well, for his films, you do. I mean,
sure. Like, with Stanley Kubrick, with Scorsese, it's the complete opposite.
Lucas.
With George, you know, exactly. But it is, you're right. There are people with singular visions and it works beautifully. I admire Linklater a lot because of his willingness to sit down with people and say, if that doesn't work, let's change it. Let's figure out what will work.
Question. Okay, because I know we have been gushing over this. just as a final thought, the one thing, it doesn't have to be the pivot, doesn't have to be when you fell in love with it.
Mm.
the one scene that you go back to when somebody says, have you seen Before Sunrise? The scene that immediately comes into your brain.
Oh, man. It's hard because every scene is just, I think of the two of them just walking. But I remember I showed somebody, I was trying to explain the movie to somebody and they didn't understand. And I was like, just watch, you know what? Just watch this moment. It was the moment that I quoted earlier where they're sitting down and he's telling her, he's like, you know, I think I'd rather know that I was really good at something and excelled in some way than to be in a loving, caring relationship. And it's not because, you know, I'm insecure. I'm afraid of commitment. It's just that, like, that means more to me. And she responds by saying, I think if there's any God or magic or anything, essentially she's saying the most important thing is for people trying to understand each other, trying to communicate with each other, even though it's impossible. The answer to just why we're here must be in that attempt. That's the scene I always think of. And then for something more fun, the scene where they're talking to each other on the fake phones.
That is an amazing love.
I think that scene sums up the movie. That scene sums up the movie perfectly. But the scene I use as like a moment of profound where I'm like, this movie goes beyond cute. It goes beyond romance to something way deeper, and it touches on something much more profound than just like, oh, we love each other and it's fun.
Right.
It's there are a lot of moments where this movie will catch you off guard and kind of you'll be like, oh wow, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great. So that's what I think of a lot when I think of these movies or this specific movie. Now without spoiling anything, without spoiling anything about the sequels.
Okay.
I will say throw these three movies into a hat and I'll pick one, and that would be my favorite. Frankly, they're all amazing for completely different reasons.
Now that's very intriguing because I can't possibly imagine a film matching this.
And again, I don't,
I want to go on record. I loved this so much. I may buy the 3-disc set.
Wow.
Okay. And I'd
encourage it.
You know, I loathe
Criterion. You can cut me a check later. Thank you.
I loathe physical media as a rule. I hate it. I went on a rant on, we have a little communication network on the Nerd Party, and I went on a rant. It's all eventually trash anyway. Blah, 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 blah. I want to see the extras. I want to see all of the stuff. I want to see the best picture quality. I want to see everything about this series. I'm honestly considering getting the set.
That makes me so, that's about the best possible reaction. And you know, it's nice that even though I do have a gun pointed at you and half of the duration of this episode, I feel like you're telling me the truth regardless. I feel like
I love this movie so much. It is fantastic, and I am very pleased to have watched it.
Ha ha ha
ha ha, ha. Now pause.
But just to give a little taste and to get you excited for the sequels, I will say number two is my favorite, Before Sunset, and it takes place in 80 minutes of real time.
Oh, snap.
Real time. Like, it's 80 minutes of them talking to each other. No breaks. They don't cheat. It is 80 minutes of real time, and I love it for that, and I love it for reasons I won't go into specifically because, like I said, do not spoil this movie. Do whatever you can to avoid anything. The joy is watching them and experiencing them. And what I love about the other two, as I was kind of touching on, is if this is the magic of falling in love for the first time and being in your 20s and life is so wonderful, they slowly but surely bring real life into it more and more as the series goes on. And it hurts a little bit, but it raises the quality of Before Sunrise in a way that I don't want to go so like crazy, but like honestly, the sequels enrich in a way that I wish every sequel could.
Well, I think I'm just going to have to bask in the glow of this for a while because I don't want to lose the magic yet.
Understandable.
I definitely do not want to lose the magic yet.
And nobody did. You know, another funny story. So they joke, the trio jokes constantly, this is the lowest grossing movie to ever spawn a sequel. when they decided to make a sequel, nobody wanted it. Like, everyone was freaking out because fans of the movie are like, that's a beautiful standard. Like what you're saying right now. I don't want to, don't touch it. Leave it alone. You made a perfect movie about this one experience. Do not ruin it by creating something else. And Julie Delpy's agent even fired her because of it. She was supposed to go audition for Rush Hour 3 or something like that, and she decided to stick around with them and write Before Sunset, the sequel. And he's
good call, Julie.
Yeah, and her agent, yeah, exactly. Her agent fired her, and he said, "You're gonna miss out on this opportunity to write a movie nobody will see and nobody wants to see." And the irony is that personally, I think Before Sunset is better. I think a lot of people feel the sequels are better than the first one.
So it's The Empire Strikes Sunrise.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
All right. So then the final question would be, what should our ranking system be?
Oh, you mean rating it?
Yeah, like a sunrise. Sunrises are too easy.
I don't care, because whatever the limit is, it gets it. No, I'm serious. You know, 100 bottles of wine from a Vienna nightclub.
100 Ferris wheels.
100 Ferris wheels.
100 random poets.
100 belly dancers. 100 harpsichords.
100 harpsichords. There we go. Perfect. All right. Well, I already gushed about this movie enough. This is if Linklater, Hawk, and Delby don't like pay us for this.
I was under the impression
they already paid us for this by making
I was under
this
the
movie.
Impression this was happening.
Yeah. So there we go. So great. Well, I'm thrilled beyond all reason that you enjoyed it. If you're listening to this and you haven't watched the movie, first of all, why would you do that to yourself? But I hope you go see the movie. Regardless, we want to hear what you think about Before Sunrise, what you think about its sequels, if you've seen those, how these movies have affected you. What are your stories about love that have a relationship that has really made a huge impact on you? We want to hear about it. So reach out to the Nerd Party at Join Nerd Party. You can reach out to me at Yay Shondor Man. John, where can people reach you?
You can find me as Kessel Junkie. I'm on kind of as this episode drops, I am actually taking a break from Twitter now.
Well, good for you.
But Kessel Junkie is who I am. I'm on just about every social network imaginable, even the ones that nobody uses. And you find me here on the network doing Great Shot Kid, which, you know, is a film analysis podcast about the works of Star Wars creators. Find me also here on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, which is about Star Wars, but the really cool nerdy stuff about it.
And he's wearing an Aggressive Negotiations t-shirt right now, and it's amazing.
Which is pretty cool. I gotta say, this is a pretty cool shirt. And I co-host Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, where we get into all sorts of zany trouble weekly. And over on the Trek FM network, I'm with Mike Schindler co-hosting Stage 9, which is what I said about the Star Wars show Great Shot Kid, but for Star Trek creators.
And we want to encourage you to go check out the rest of the shows on the Nerd Party, because they're all great. I love all these people. They're doing really, really cool stuff. Go ahead and rate us on iTunes if you like us. 5 stars. Even if you hate us, 5 stars, we'll love you forever.
We won't tell anyone. With 5 stars of passion.
Exactly. Hate us on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being the most hatred.
Right.
Give us that.
Whatever you feel about the show, it's 5 stars worth of it.
Well, John, thank you so much for sitting here and watching this movie with me. I hope that maybe we can return to the sequels, perhaps in future episodes. But regardless, when you're ready for it, I hope you get around to watching them. And I hope you people out there get around to watching them if you haven't already. Go do it. They're great.
Yes, they are. Well, the first one is.
Who knows? Who knows about the other two? All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Have a wonderful day.